Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. This is the Sound Delph Option Show with Richard Talk to Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Richard. Good morning to all of our listeners. We have an incredibly special guest today. We always have special guests, but this one, all of us need, any of us who talk or feel, need to hear Sarah Eliason. She's the author of Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with People Like Us. So she's admitted to being a difficult person. And I have my computer's just rebooting. Excuse those little noises in the background here. My computer crashed, as always, 2 minutes before the show. We're going to be talking to her, and we have lots of questions. You can ask questions, too, by joining the chat with Richard over on Blog Talk Radio, 347-850-1407. We are not doing WebEx today. Richard, is there another way for them to get in touch with the chat over there?
Yes. You can go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on Blog Talk Radio, and in the description for Sarah's or Sam's show today, down there on the bottom right-hand side is a link that you can click, and that'll take you directly to the page for today where you can join the chat. So that means just like when we do WebEx, you can add chat here, and you can also listen to the show there at the same time if you like. And I always like the audio at Blog Talk Radio. It's quite solid. So there's that
is
way.
Sam,
go ahead.
Is Sam a nickname for our guest?
Yes. Yep. Right in her bio,
okay.
She says, Sarah Sam Elliston. So we'll ask her about that.
Okay.
I was gonna also add in that, particularly because today we're doing the Blog Talk Radio only, no WebEx, that after the show, because I know there's enough information from everything that I've read about Sam and reading her book, Sherry, I love that description. If you feel or talk, you're going to want this book. So if you fit into any of those categories, get this book. I'm telling you now, it's great information, great exercises, kind of a, you know, tough attitude in a positive way, but it's great information. So if you want to, when you want to listen to the show again, you can again go to Sound Health Options, click on the radio tab, and then to hear the replay about 10 or 15 minutes after the show, you'll be able to click on the Blog Talk Radio Archive button, and that'll take you to the player for the last 5 shows.
That is awesome. We are going to be doing some shows about people and what's good or bad or difficult. The next show we're going to do is about complaints. What does complaining really mean? So I'd like to ask all of our listeners to send us their definition of what a complaint from your neighbor, your spouse, your child, what does that really mean? Like, is complaining a public announcement that you feel powerless to do anything about the situation? So we're going to be doing a whole show about that, and that will be great. I have one little announcement next week. Thursday and Friday is our free 2-day workshop, and we are giving away the Perfect Mate software. So if you're having difficulty with finding a mate, a spouse, a partner, this is a sneaky way to do it. You can talk into this little computer program, and it will tell you what your faults are and what kind of a mate you would be, and then also who you're looking for. Then you can compare the person you're sort of considering and see what kind of trouble you might have. And during class, we're going to see if we can help you around some of that trouble. Like, we recently had a couple in here, and he was all early American, and she was all chrome and glass, and they were having trouble. He lived with his mom. She was very sexual. Because of his mother, he didn't want to be sexual. So you could see right in their vocal print that their F and F sharp was just really unmatching. So we were able to tell them what kind of trouble they were going to be facing. And with that information, like our guest today, you'll be able to do something about it as soon as you can recognize what's really happening. Okay, that's my one announcement, Richard.
Mine isn't quite as jolly. Well, actually, it's pretty darn jolly for me. McKesson, the fifth largest company in the United States. Who knew? McKesson Pharmaceuticals, or drugs, or whatever they call themselves, is paying McKesson to pay $150 million after alleged failure to report suspicious orders. So they're not... So far, I mean, they're contesting it somewhat, but it has to do with oxycodone and hydrocodone pills. According to the DEA, the distributors supplied various U.S. pharmacies an increasing amount of oxycodone and hydrocodone pills from 2008 until 2013. This is how current we are. This is 3 years ago. Under the settlement, McKesson is required to suspend controlled substances sales from distribution centers in several states, and numerous, you know, Ohio, Michigan, Florida, and a few others. And the according to the DEA, the staged suspensions are among the most severe sanctions ever agreed to by a DEA-registered distributor. So I'm not completely clear because of how this is written. I'll put this link in the chat at Blog Talk Radio. And here, somebody from the DEA, the acting administrator, everybody's acting administrators these days with the new government taking mock control. I need some counseling from Sam on this, that part. This groundbreaking resolution is tough and appropriate and underscores our commitment to hold accountable all DEA registrants, including those who distribute controlled substances. Now, to just sort of close this thought out, McKesson previously agreed to pay $13.25 million in 2008 for similar violations.
Is it just oxycodone and some of those really?
It seems to be, some of the more, you know, the opiates, the opiate families.
The street drugs.
The street. I'm not quite sure. The way this is written, it doesn't tell me exactly why this was an issue, but it's an issue. And part of what I'm observing is that they did this in 2008, paid a fine. They've done it again, paid a fine. Is anybody going to jail? Is something actually happening? So that's my, cool. You know, anytime a pharmaceutical company can be brought to task, I'm happy because I think that's good. But on the other hand, really, what's happening? You know, they're paying fines. They probably made $1 squillion. I tried to look that up, but I didn't have enough time to figure it out. It's just, wow.
$1 billion. Never heard that before.
Well, I didn't know that this actually was one of the really surprising things, is that McKesson is the fifth largest company in the United States. I mean, that's up there. If you put, you know, Google and Apple – and probably another tech company, that doesn't leave a lot of slots. What is that, like Exxon and then McKesson? I mean, that's an amazing concept. Largest, one of the top five companies in the country. That's amazing.
I'd never heard of them. Isn't that awful?
It's an old, I think it's a brand that isn't used. It's not really a brand. It's really the mothership, and they probably have numerous brands. I'll do a little more research. Okay.
There's been so much of that go around here in Southern Ohio, that people getting prescriptions from this doctor and that doctor, you know, all for the same, and then they go sell these for like $50 a pop on the street.
Yeah. Okay.
And these people are facilitating that.
That's right. Putting it out there. And maybe our guests can help me with some of that attitude, my cranky, cantankerous attitude about that. Sarah Sam Elliston is an expert in the art of dealing with difficult people. She's a top workshop leader and a member of the faculty of the William Glasser Institute, which espouses reality therapy to foster behavioral change. Her instructional career began long ago, long before she even became aware that she was herself a difficult person. Traits that began in Lincoln, Massachusetts, where she grew up. For more than 30 years, she's been teaching and training, first as a high school teacher in Ohio and Cincinnati, then as an administrator in the not-for-profit sector. Her passion is training and designing an experience that allows learners to find a process that works for them to make the changes they desire. Sam is gentle, persistent, humorous, and an intelligent trainer. She draws from many sources and is always willing to admit that she might not know the answer. On Sam's site, Sam's mission statement is, "My mission is to help people to stand up for themselves and all people to regain peaceful relationship." Sam joins us to talk about her new book, Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Live with People Like Us. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
You bet. I'm ready for therapy. I want to lay down on the couch. No.
I was just looking at McKesson here while you guys were talking, and I've never heard of it as a company. It's quite interesting.
Well, and that's the amazing thing, to have that kind of presence and be the fifth largest company in the United States, and the three of us have really never heard of them. That's amazing.
Well, they do retail sales, so they sell the stuff to Walmart, and then we buy it from Walmart, right?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I think
that's
so.
Why we've never heard of them.
Yeah, okay.
Subsidiary.
But that's still pretty stealthy.
Celestio, PSS, Perse Technologies. Anyway, I was just looking in while up here. Anyway.
Okay.
Yes.
So now,
okay.
What was your I'll call it a tipping point, for you realizing you were a difficult person?
It's a good story. I'll tell you in a minute, but I just want to make sure that our listeners know my name is Sarah Elliston with a T, and my website is sarahelliston.com. So if you wanted to buy the book, that's where you get it. And my nickname is Sam, and you're welcome to call me Sam. It's just like, if you look for Sam Elliston, you won't find me.
Right,
probably.
Thank you. Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
That's okay. So the tipping point was, I was 50 years old, and I had a new boss whom I highly respected, and she really liked me. She had lots of positive things to say about my work. I think I'd worked for her for 3 or 4 months. And she said to me one day as we were talking about something that she liked about what I was doing, and she said, you have this other really bad habit of getting very upset and making it so that the rest of us can't do our work. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. What do I do? She said, you know what? I'll just wait till the next time you do it. And I'll tell you. I said, okay. I didn't hear it as negative criticism. I just didn't know what she was talking about. And then when I misplaced my very first pair of very expensive glasses, reading glasses, which I never spent that much money again, but I misplaced them over a lunch break, and I never did find them. But I spent probably 20 minutes stomping around and looking for them and in and out of the office and opening drawers and picking up my coat and muttering under my breath and just generally creating some havoc in the energy. And she said, Sarah, inside, in here. She sat me and she said, that, what you're doing right now, that needs to stop. And I said, what am I doing? Honestly. I wasn't lying or being disingenuous. I really didn't know what I was doing. And she pointed out that I'm picking papers up and dropping them and opening files and lifting the flippers, that you have in these cubicle offices and slamming them down and just generally muttering and making kind of a racket without any regard for my colleagues. And she didn't say you're being disrespectful. She said, you're doing this, and you're talking under your breath, and you're swearing, and we can't get our work done. We can't focus when there's this kind of negative energy going on. And I said, oh, golly, I had A, no idea I was doing it, and B, I really wasn't aware that anybody else was aware of me. And I don't know if that's part of the definition of narcissism, where you're just not aware of other people, but I was just puttering through my moment and wasn't really paying attention to the fact that anyone else might be bothered. So that was a major moment for me in terms of thinking, oh my God, look what I'm doing. This isn't helpful. And I sat down and I started to, my second thought was, wow, I wonder if I do this all the time. And so I asked when I went home, I asked my husband and my son, and they said, oh yeah, you have these little temper tantrums, or you have, you know, you get into little snits periodically. But, you know, we don't pay much attention to them. It's just who you are. You get over it really fast, and you never mean it, whatever it is you say. And I thought, this isn't good. I wasn't happy with it. I started to really pay attention to how I was. It took longer for this, but I began to realize that the way I interacted with the leadership in our organization probably came across to them as arrogant and, I don't know, cocky, or in some cases I know at least one supervisor who felt I was threatening his authority because I sound like I know what I'm talking about and I treat them like equals as opposed to waiting to hear what they want me to do. I remember one job interview, for example, where I got all the way to the tippy top. I went through like 5 or 6 different interviews and got all the way to the interview with the CEO. And then I blew it because I asked the first question. And afterwards, she told me, she said, you can't take control of an interview like that. And I had no idea I was taking control of an interview. I was just asked, I thought, here we are. We're supposed to be asking each other questions. I'll ask him a question. So there was a lack of knowledge on my part, and what it turned out to be was people perceived me as difficult and hard to work with because I argued and I asked questions, and they perceived it as a threat to them. I didn't intend it to be, but I was not aware that they were perceiving it that way. So my premise is that difficult people are not being malicious, and they're not being deliberately unkind or threatening or whatever it is that you're perceiving. They're just doing what they do because no one's ever told them not to, or no one's ever explained it to them in a way that they understood. I wish I had a more elegant way of saying that, but I don't know how else to say it. It's just what I realized as I started to really look at my life and started to ask people, why don't we tell each other these things? And I started leading workshops on dealing with difficult people. I'd already been doing some workshops on dealing with difficult volunteers. It was part of my job. But outside my job, I started looking at dealing with difficult people, and part of what I was asking was, will this work? And the feedback I got was yes. But it was also, you've allowed this person to become so difficult that you need to come to a workshop to figure out how to talk to them. Excuse me. And what I begin to see is that we aren't really taught how to resolve interpersonal conflicts in our day-to-day activity. I don't think our television teaches us that. I don't. It's all people yelling or having conflict. Actually, nobody watches the show unless there's some kind of conflict. So there's manipulation and lying and things going on in the media that we learn from. So my point is that people are uncomfortable just saying, hey, what you're doing is wrong and you should stop, because it usually you have your next show next week is all about complaining. And I was going to say, usually what happens is people complain and complain and complain, and by the time they get to the difficult person, they're so full of negativity and angst, if you will, that they can't make a statement about the behavior of the other person without putting a judgment into it. And that's sort of the first step.
I love the Cosby Show because it was about conflict resolution.
Yeah.
And shows like that just don't exist anymore.
But
one of the things I have learned in my 70-some years on the planet is that people react negatively to you to keep you from repeating the same response. So they're going to yell and scream at you so you'll not approach them again. That's been a difficult thing for me. And the other is put downs, that people will say things deliberately to put you down. It took me a long time to realize that's their power play.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk about a couple of those things?
Well, put downs, there's seven habits that are considered toxic that we teach about in the Glasser Institute, and they seem to make awfully good sense. Complaining, criticizing, blaming, nagging, threatening, punishing, bribing, or rewarding to control. And I think what you're talking about falls in there, in the toxic habits. We fall into the habit because it's something that we've learned and we've seen it succeed with others. And so, I mean, in terms, if I was going to be able to call in about complaining, like what does it really mean, next your topic for next week, I think indeed the person who's complaining doesn't know they have any other, has given up on looking for other ways to get change in their lives. And ask me again now, the power play, as you were saying, that people that people give us negative criticism because of something inside them, whatever it is. So it's some unhealed hurt or whatever, and so their way of thinking that they can control the world is to be sarcastic or negative or argumentative.
I'd like to give us a situation. I was having a conversation this morning with my husband, and it was about something that someone had written on the internet, and you could just tell that they were so hurt and so devastated, but all he could concentrate on is it had two typos. And it was like we were from different planets trying to talk about the situation.
Well, what he finds important is different from what you find important.
Well, that's
is that too simple?
Quick and easy way to do it, or to say it.
Were you saying his comment about the two typos, was he being sarcastic and cruel, or was that what he cared about?
He said that nobody should put anything like that on the internet until they run spell check and they do this and they get good grammar. And I said, sometimes when you're really upset, and you tell this woman is, that's not the first thing that comes to mind.
Were you feeling he was unsympathetic?
Yes. And I felt like he was being difficult because he didn't see it my way, as you just put in my face. I felt like he was not being supportive of this person that was really reaching out to us for help. And I didn't know what about it.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm trying to think. Let's just say if you wanted to walk it through the filters that I'm suggesting in the book, you'd need to be thinking about the fact that when you say he's not being supportive, that's your interpretation of his behavior, right?
Yes, but I don't see how I could go talk to somebody who's in such a upset state about their grammar and spelling errors.
It's not something that you would do. No, clearly. But if you're wanting to invite your husband to consider changing, what is the impact of his making a statement about, you know, the grammar and the needing the spell check and the two typos, the impact does it makes you feel like he's an insensitive blob?
Well, it really hurt our friend's feelings that that's what he came back at her
okay,
with.
Okay, so it was your friend. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought it was just something that you read on the internet.
Well, she wrote to us on the internet.
And his only, he wrote a response saying, this is what you should have done?
There's two
or
typos
he said it
here.
To you?
He said it to me that this is what I should write back to her.
Ah, okay. So, but you didn't write it back to her, so it wouldn't have hurt her feelings. She wouldn't know.
But he's very apt to say things like that to people.
Okay. So he's a very literal person in that sense.
Yeah, literal is a good word for it. Unsympathetic.
Well, what you're looking for is how do you describe the person's behavior? You're saying he's insensitive, he's hurting people's feelings. And my reaction is, well, that's possible, but what he's doing is giving you a literal reaction to their grammar is incorrect and the spell check wasn't used. Even spell check doesn't always catch everything. So someone should have proofread this before the person sent it. Those are the kind of the guidelines or the rules that he lives by for the internet. That's the behavior. There's nothing really, what's the opposite of benign? I can see why if you're feeling emotional, you would look at that and say that's insensitive. His reaction is I'm reacting to the way this was written and the style and the rules that I write things by. It's not intended to be cruel. It's not intended to be insensitive. It's just this is the way I react to these things. And you're asking, I think what you're saying is when you do that, I feel like you're not paying attention to the pathos here or the emotion here or the concerns that the writer is writing about. Is that correct? Would that be the impact of his behavior?
Well, I think his impact to me was, I don't want to get involved because she's a bad speller.
I think you're interpreting?
I absolutely am.
Yeah, okay. So interpreting someone's behavior is kind of, well, you can do it, but you're getting into his business if you've read the book. There's a whole concept of whose business are you in? Your business, his business, or God's business? And your business is everything to do with you, his business is everything to do with him, and God's business is everything else. So when we start interpreting somebody's behavior, well, you're doing this because we're in their business. We're thinking they should be different because we think we know more than they do, and we think we know what's right for them. And it is the hardest pill to swallow, and I'm not very good at it myself. But I will tell you that interpreting his behavior, if you interpreted my behavior that way, it would only make me more resistant to change.
Well, when I ask him, why do you think her spelling errors are important when she's so upset? And he says, because that's the way we are taught to write. And it was a whole different street. I wasn't down that street. But I can see where you're coming from and how I should have backed off.
Well, I don't know if it's what you should have done. It's just that you're an emotional person. You definitely were feeling whatever she was asking for help, and she was in panic mode, or and she wrote it quickly. And what you cared about was what she was asking for. And for whatever reason, his response was focused on the way it was written. Go ahead.
I just didn't feel he was being very supportive.
Yep. Is that your job? Ooh, was that too blunt?
Is it my job to support my friend?
Is it your job to tell your husband that he's not being supportive? Has he asked you to tell him that?
We've been together 40-some years, so...
Yeah.
Does he
appreciate it when you say, you know, you could be more supportive here? I mean, if he is typically more concerned with the structure of the essay than the content of the essay, Have you worked this out before, where you've had to say, "Hey, you could be a little bit more supportive"?
Well, I didn't say it that way. I said, "Oh, do you think that is supportive, a supportive way to talk to her?" But I don't want to make this all about one situation that upset me. I want this to be a broader concept of how people could deal with difficult people. And
well,
I guess at this point, I need to rush out and buy your book.
Well, the formula is to look at the specific behavior. We've been with somebody for 40 years. Then you do start interpreting why they do something the way they do it. I can remember saying to the last man that I was close to for a couple of years, I was like, stop deciding that if I act this way once, that's what I always want, or that's the way I always am. I really felt I was being, quote, interpreted. But that's very different from a 40-year relationship. So I don't intend to be critical of what you did, but if you can describe the behavior and its impact on you or another person or a family member or whoever, and what the consequence might be for not changing. Now, in this case, the example you just gave me, there's not much of a consequence except that you get annoyed. But sometimes there's a significant consequence if the person doesn't change. I probably would have lost my job if I said, tough beans, this is the way I am, to my supervisor in the situation that I described. Once you're able to be really clear about what the behavior is, then there's some questions you have to ask yourself, and that's the rest of the book. That's the exercises that Richard was talking about, where one of the exercises is, whose business are you in? And how do you just want the other person to be different because you want them to be different? Because you think they'd be a better person if they were different? Because that's really not our business. And it's really hard to accept that, because I don't think there's much in our culture that supports it. But the minute we decide we know something is better or somebody should be different because we know what will work for them, and so we start putting the pressure on that way, we're really asking for a lot of pain. And that's not what we're looking for. So there are a number of different, exercises that you go through. Sometimes one of them is who does the person remind you of? And sometimes the difficult person, we don't know why, they just make us bristle because of their reaction to us. Somebody calls me Sarah, which is what my piano teacher called me when I was growing up. I really, my teeth start to itch. I bristle when someone calls me Sarah, and then I say to myself, now you're a mature adult and you don't have to treat this person the way you wanted to treat your piano teacher. And so I try to be more adult about it, but I still have that visceral reaction. And sometimes we have a reaction to someone and their behavior, and it's because of somebody in our past. And it helps. It's always helped me to say, well, now who does this person remind me of before I decide that I want to make a correction or invite them to make a correction?
Well, I'll toss this in regarding Sarah. evidently, I was a difficult child because this was in elementary school. It might have started before that, but definitely I remember a scene in elementary school where first day of school, a teacher called, my name's Richard, and so a teacher would call me Dick, and I didn't like it, not because of the other, you know, other meanings or anything. I just didn't like the sound of it. I didn't like the way it felt when I was very clear, even at a young age, and was a little bit, you know, reprimanded for being sort of like a do adult. But I was just very clear that I wanted to be called Richard.
Well, I mean, I think at that age, we're taught to be polite to adults, but I think we can say what we want to be called. I mean, I don't see that as difficult. If you were hostile to everybody for the rest of your life, whoever called you Dick, and in a hostile way said, don't call me Dick, I mean, that might be a little difficult. But
yeah.
But as and how style, do, I don't think so.
Yeah, I was just very clear. I wasn't so, you know, this is my personality most 90% of the time. Right now, I don't become a different person on radio. I'm shy in person, but on radio, I'm just more willing to talk. But I'm not contentious by nature. I'm actually one of those people that would rather walk away from potential contention than confront it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you used that word, because one of the other main points about my book is that I would rather have a conversation with someone than a confrontation. And we're taught in communication skills classes is that you have to work up to a confrontation, and that very word suggests conflict. And I contend, and I've experienced it myself, and I've had some feedback that it works for other people, that if you really are clear on what it is you want to say to the other person in terms of just their behavior, what they say, what they're actually doing, without any judgments, mm-hmm. without all those complaining, criticizing, negative words that we use, which would make probably, you know, television very boring, but if we can do that and describe that behavior, my hunch is the other, and ask them if A, they know that they're doing it, and B, is that what they want? That's having an impact on others, and is that the impact that they want? Usually their response is no, they didn't know they were doing it. But, of course, it's not their fault. You know, there's always some defensiveness initially, but it allows for a conversation. So it's not just a whap, whap, you're doing this, it's wrong, you should change. That's a confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm aiming for a conversation. And there are a number of examples of some of them in the book.
Right. And what I want to back up ever so slightly and ask about,
sure.
You use a phrase, of toxic habits.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this fits into the, is there a definition of a difficult person, or is it kind of go hand in hand with these toxic habits?
Oh, you mean how would I describe a difficult person? I don't really have a good one. I think people that are living by the toxic habits definitely are difficult. Those are the ones that we usually don't want to hang out with a whole lot. But no, I don't have a perfect definition. I think there's usually some aggression and there's usually some anger, whether it's full-fledged or just sort of a low rumbling coming from some kind of who knows where it comes from. But all of us have someone in our life, at least there are only about 3 or 4 people in my life that I know who don't have difficult people in their lives. And they're all those three women are all in their 80s, you know, so they've kind of gotten themselves to a place of balance with the rest of the world. Most of us have someone that gives us an itch that we cheerfully like to strangle. And but they're all different. they're all different.
Yeah,
I know every person that I've talked to about the book in terms of when I was writing it and then when I got an editor and then talking to people about the brand and marketing, they all wanted to know what a difficult person was. And I'm always sort of like, do you not have one? That's wonderful. I mean, I applaud the fact that you don't have anyone in your life who's not difficult. And they say, oh, yeah, well, what are they like? You know, they argue, they complain, they criticize, they nag, they gossip. I don't think that's listed as one of the toxic habits, but I think it's definitely one that makes life difficult. They look at the negative.
And let's counter that by you have this other wonderful
list.
The happy list. The happy
yeah.
list. The caring habit.
Yeah.
How do we, you know, how do we build those? And then after you ask that, do that, I want to talk about acceptance.
Yeah. Well, the first caring habit is supporting, which is what Sherry was wanting her husband to be, you know, to support, be supportive of other folks, to encourage, to listen, to be accepting, to trust. And I think in our world right now, it's tough to trust. to respect and then negotiate differences. So negotiate differences, have a conversation, I guess that would fall into the same place. So not to instantly say, oh, well, they can't do that, we need to get them to change, and say, oh, well, that's not the way we do it. I wonder if we can talk about why they do it their way and what their goals are, and if there's some we can come to a compromise, that kind of thing. So supporting, encouraging, listening, accepting, trusting, respecting, and negotiating differences. The thing I love about those lists are we teach them to teachers who are studying reality therapy so they can use the methods in the classroom, the methods of just working with people. They're not doing therapy in the classroom. And when they post those two lists on the wall and they start emphasizing with their kids, is that a toxic habit or a caring habit, everything changes in the classroom. And the teachers report, of course, that their lives get better because they're less focused on the toxic habits and more on the caring habits. And you want to talk about acceptance?
Well, I want to toss in, I want to see the list of caring habits on the business place. I want to see it on the wall at Facebook. I'm not picking on Facebook. It's just the company that comes to mind. I'm not like, Facebook, that's a separate show. But, you know, that would be awesome.
Yeah. I've been a facilitator for some groups and some companies right around here in Cincinnati where the professor who teaches reality therapy here, he takes it right out there to the corporations, and I've gone along and been part of his team in presenting that. And the supervisors are awkward with it at first, but they can see the difference. Because if you're asking people what it is they want, and then what are they doing, and if it's working, and you're doing it as a supportive thing, not a critical thing, then people will tell you, then they'll thrive, and you would have a much better business.
Well, and it's such a, I think that does lean into the acceptance where it seems like there is a certain amount of acceptance in this, mm-hmm. in that, you know, you really, first you have to be willing to accept the person as they are in a certain way. I have a person in my life that I care about, and there are certain aspects of her that drive me crazy, but I've learned down to the years, we've known each other for a long time, and there are lots of, you know, 80% of the time everything's good, and there's a certain area that gets wonky, and occasionally we bump into it, but for the most part, I just set it aside. Because it's not vital to the overall ongoing thing. And occasionally something floats up and I say something and then we both back off like, you know, dogs that have had a slight row for a while, that kind of thing. So that it does seem like there is a certain amount of going into the conversation without an aggressive, you know, like sort of that Caesar Milan, the dog whisperer. You don't go into it. You go into, you know, being calm, assertive is much more effective than chest beating, cranky, snarling teeth. Did I go too far there?
No. I think it's absolutely right. And I hadn't thought of it from that perspective. I think where I like to go is when I'm interacting with others or in my relationships is to take the person exactly where they are, which I guess is maybe acceptance, but not interpreting their behavior and not trying to figure them out. I have some close friends that I, you know, I challenge sometimes with my questions, and then they challenge me right back. So, I mean, and with people that you know for a long time, you can do that, but you're still doing it from, let's say, a supportive place. But and that's, I'm just sort of stumbling here because I'm thinking, I think the book is saying, or my premise here with the book is, unless you can look at your difficult person without all the negative feelings, without all the judgments that we lay on our descriptions of their behavior, and however many weeks or months or years that you've been holding on to it, unless then there's not much point in considering the conversation. One of my favorite quotes is that, you know, anger and resentment is like taking poison and expecting the other person to die. So when we're holding negative emotions and judgments about the other person, even if we're right, it's still us taking the poison, expecting them to die. And so of what use is it? It isn't. And the other quote that I like a lot is Dale Carnegie, who said, "It isn't what you have, it isn't what you who you are or where you are, or what you do that makes you happy or unhappy. It's what you think about it." And that's where I start. It's like, if I'm looking at this other person from a perspective of, and I've had a negative neighbor, believe me. I don't know if neighbors came up before when you were talking about complaining, but I was thinking about a neighbor that I had for 25 years who liked to go out and shoot guns in his backyard. And we had long, narrow backyards, and ours, you know, paralleled his. And I had a small person in my family, and I would go over and say, "If you're going to shoot guns this afternoon, you need to come tell me first, because I'm not going to let my son play out back if you're out there shooting guns." And he'd say, "Oh, we'll just teach him how to shoot." No, that's not where I'm going. And we went around and around. I didn't call him names. I didn't criticize him to his face, but I had very strong opinions about people that are shooting guns in their backyard, and so I was not being very accepting of him. It would be an example of what not to do, but his son would come over and tell us if they decided they were going to, you know, do some target shooting that day. So I at least got what I wanted, which was I didn't want my son out in the back 40 while, it wasn't 40, but, you know, back land while they were, you know, 10 feet away shooting in their back land.
Right. And is some of the, it sounds like as you're describing that some of this is about building or creating good boundaries. Is that true?
Yes, it is. It is. And, you know, okay. I didn't use the word boundary in the book because I felt like it was kind of overused. Like, oh, well, if you just had better boundaries.
Yeah.
So I didn't use that. I just saw another quote that I try to remember to live by, that we do not see things the way they are. We see things the way we are. So, like, in my conversation with my neighbor, I wasn't able to see him as someone who found, they went hunting. I mean, they caught, you know, they killed deer and lived by it, and so it was part of their livelihood, and they also saw it as a sport. I didn't have any appreciation for that. The way I was seeing things the way I was, which was shooting guns is bad. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of a value that I was holding, and so I was not at peace because of that. But boundaries, the whole idea of whose business are you in is all about boundaries.
Right.
And it is, I learned it from a woman named Byron Katie. I don't know if you've ever heard of her.
Mm-hmm.
She's established a process called The Work, and it's free, and it's right on her website. It's called thework.com. And she has a process that if you're unhappy or uncomfortable with someone, some questions that you can ask yourself. And in going through this questioning process, one of the questions that I love is, who would you be without the thought? The thought that, say, for Sherry's husband should be more sensitive and less worried about grammar and more supportive of their friend. And who would you be without the thought? Certainly a lot more peaceful and a lot more comfortable. And it's not to say one is right or wrong. When you work through or go through her process called The Work, you kind of end up learning. It's not always easy, but it's just as true as it is untrue.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her premises is that one of her guidelines is this whole idea of whose business are you in? Because essentially, if it really doesn't help us to be in somebody else's business. We're not happy in there, and they're not happy in there. But I think our world or our culture tells us we have a right to be in someone else's business when we think we have the answer or we think they're wrong.
Or when we're their boss and we need to get the job done.
Ah, there you go. I think the employment area is certainly one that people have talked to me about a lot, and I've done some coaching on that. And you certainly can follow this process that I'm teaching in the book without getting into their business, because the impact of them continuing a behavior that's causing problems, that whatever the behavior is, whatever the impact is on the team or the customer or the clients or whoever, if it's having a negative impact and you can demonstrate that and they still don't want to change, then, you know, there's a fairly clear consequence that they won't be working there anymore. But most of the people I've talked to don't want to have to fire someone. I actually had a guy come to my workshop who came to learn how to fire his employee. And their dialogue is in the book, because the employee had become more negative on the job. Just even though he was a good worker, he became more and more negative just in the way he was approaching things. But he was still getting his work done, but he had new responsibility where he was supervising new employees because the company was growing. And so his supervisor, the man that came to my workshop, said, I got to fire this guy because he's going to make all these new people negative and disrespectful of the company, and I don't want to fire him because we've worked together for years and I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say to him. And so we worked through the process, and he ended up not having to fire him. But they did have to have a number of conversations about, do you realize that you're doing this? And getting the denial of, oh, well, that's just who I am. Don't pay any mind. I've been like this for years. My dad was like this. It's not a big deal. That kind of thing, where the supervisor had to say, it is a big deal. It's a whole new company. It's a whole new way of doing business. We've got new people being trained, and you're part of that. And do you see how your behavior could impact them in a negative way so that they feel like they can say all these negative things about the company? It took him a while, but he did begin to see it. And because they weren't having a confrontation, although the employee was like, oh, you want me to stop? You want me to quit? Or, like, what's going to happen? You're going to fire me. And he says, I don't want to fire you. And this is what you're doing, and this is what the impact is, and is that what you want? That question of, is that what you want, giving the other person the opportunity to really reflect on their own behavior and then decide how they want to be, is also a key piece of what I'm trying to teach.
Well, part of the amazing thing to me in there is a boss that's caring enough or wants to be involved enough in their employees' lives to want to actually do that versus just saying, you're wrong, you're stupid, get out, or however it comes down. Versus just firing them. I mean, I think that's...
Firing people is really expensive.
Yeah.
Although I've been a number of different business radio shows where they say, well, how come we have to be nice to these guys? And I said, well, if they have the skills you want and they've already worked for you for a while, isn't it cheaper in the long run to take some time and effort and really have a conversation versus firing them and having to find someone new and train someone? And everybody has foibles, as you said. You know, your friend has things about her that drive you crazy. I'm sure Sherry's got things that drive her husband crazy and vice versa. We all do. But that's not what we're talking about. That doesn't make them necessarily difficult.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about because I'm stunned to find we're rounding the bend on time.
Oh, gosh.
I know. It happens. It's a vortex. We fall into a wormhole of like, wow, this is good. Talk about our five basic needs.
Oh,
because I think
that
might give us a good framework for motivation, or I don't know what the word would be.
Well, one of the things we start to do when we interpret somebody else's behavior is we start to figure out why they do what they do. And what I love about this motivation theory is something that Dr. Glasser teaches that's called choice theory, is that we have five basic needs that are programmed into our brains, and based on trying to get those needs met, that's what drives all of our behavior. And the needs are the need to feel accepted and loved and belonged, some kind of connection, and that's pretty much the most important one. Then the others will come in a variety of intensities. They're different for each person, but there's a need for fun, a need for some kind of learning and enjoyment. And that's part of fun. A need for freedom, a need to have a sense that you're making choices, and then a need for achievement or power, a sense of empowerment, not power and control over others, but that I have some power in myself, and then a need for survival, for reproduction, food, shelter, clothes. And those four, well, survival is more of a biological need, but all of them are driving our behavior all the time. So we get information that comes into all we get from the world is information. It comes into our systems, in our head, and based on whether it's what we want or not, or what we think we deserve, or we're hoping for, we will act in a certain way. We'll say or do something. People don't usually know what they're doing. They know what they're feeling. They know what they're thinking. They may or may not be aware of their physiology, but in terms of their actual physical doing and what they're saying, they do it so much, they're not really aware of it. And so when you invite someone to, say, walk differently, it's a real struggle because they aren't even thinking about how they walk. And yet when we walk differently, it helps our back or our thighs or whatever part of our body that, you know, the physical therapist is suggesting that we improve. And the irony is that changing what we do, what we say and how we act, is much easier than changing our thoughts and our feelings. But we spend a lot of time on, I wish I felt this way, I wish I thought that. Well, my suggestion is if you change what you do, how you are physically in the world, and what you say, and then, of course, live by all those wonderful caring habits, your thoughts and feelings will become more positive. Did that answer your question? The reason I like the motivation model is knowing that everybody's always trying to get their needs met takes the necessity for interpreting someone's behavior away from it. So that's maybe one of the major steps in accepting the other person wherever they are. So they may be doing something completely crazy, but they think it's going to help them get one or more of those needs met. And we may see that it's not working, but it's all they know, or it's all they've ever tried. So they keep doing it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so that's where the toxic habits come from. If we see everybody complaining, on Facebook, I'm really getting tired of all the negativity on Facebook. It's beginning to change. At least on my Facebook, friends are starting to say, okay, what can we do that's positive? Let's look at this. Let's try to have a positive perspective because it's getting us down. But if you live by those toxic habits and that's all you know, then you're certainly going to become a difficult person.
Right.
But if it's all you know how to do and you keep doing it, people, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And yet we all do that. You know, you lose your keys, you go and you look all the different places for them, and you go back and you look again and you look again and you look again. We all do that.
Boy, howdy. I was chuckling about the five basic needs because it reminds me very much of the wolf culture. Wolves want freedom. They want, you know, they want survival is number one.
Uh-huh.
When they travel, they let the slowest, you know, we would consider them elderly, but the slowest wolves lead.
Mm-hmm.
So the pack acknowledges that and goes, okay, let's follow Bob because Bob's slowest, or Sally,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, whoever you want it to be. And mm-hmm. another thing about wolves is they stop and play every 30 minutes.
No kidding, really?
Yep. They actually take a, you know, I don't know how they have their sundial or no. Well, I mean, you know, they're,
yeah.
you know, they know. But, I mean, they take breaks, regular breaks, when traveling. I mean, they're not under threat, but, you know, when they're traveling, they take
mm-hmm.
breaks and play. That's
mm-hmm.
part of their life is that's we want to have fun with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And yet
mm-hmm.
we, you know, when somebody does get out of line or gets too stupid, they'll get nipped.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no, that you're going to hurt.
There's a consequence,
you know,
for that one.
There's consequence for that, and they're very straightforward
yeah.
about it. It's not, they're not going to bite you just to bite you, unless they're going to eat you. But, I mean, within their packs, they really have a pretty good system of, you know, you're out of line, nip, get back in line. You know, you're threatening the survival. It's much more of a positive survival thing. So I'm a big fan of, you know, watching the animal world, because the animal world doesn't have so much psychodynamic issues or load as the human species does. So
that's true. That's true. That's
very
fun.
Nice.
Go ahead, Sherry.
I just said that is a very nice analogy. You know, and when you start talking to people, remember to talk in a place where they can understand you first. And analogy about wolves really makes it clear to animal lovers, and maybe that'll make it clear to humans where they're coming from. Because
mm-hmm.
sometimes I feel like I'm not speaking the same language. I'm not finding that common place to even start a conversation.
Hmm.
So that's my difficulty. But I liked your analogy, Richard.
Thank you.
Too.
How do we? I want to move to the close, but I have to ask this question.
Go ahead.
How do we start the conversation? I would call it breaking the ice, but I mean, how do we start the conversation?
Well, let's first pretend. I'd say, Richard, I value you as a friend. I want to keep you as a friend, and I need to talk to you about something. I don't think you know you're doing it. Sometimes when you get really passionate, and you want to talk to me about something you really care about, it, you shake your finger at me. And that makes me feel like I'm being chastised or told that I'm wrong. And I'm not sure you know that you're doing it. Do you know you're doing it?
Is there a camera in here? I do point. I do wave, and I apologize for people. No, I do. But I apologize to people in person. I say the problem, you know, the trick with me is that I do radio, so there is a lot of gesticulating that people don't see.
Me too.
And in person, I'm not inclined toward the pointy finger, but it happens because I'm on radio. You know, I'm pointing at things. I've got a fist up.
Yeah. There's an outline in the book, in the back of the book, about, you know, here's how a conversation might go. I usually start with what I value about the other person and invite my, you know, participants and the people that I'm coaching. If you can't make a list of what you value about that person, you need to go back and start over. That's one of the exercises. Because if you're still just saying that person is a lazy, no good son of a... Well, you're not in a good place to have the conversation.
And then I have a question from chat. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. What's the question?
How do you deal with interrupting? I don't mean our banter, but, you know, in that, how do you deal with that kind of, what do you do with that?
Man, it's really tough. I like to start by looking at the person and thinking to myself, this person really has a lot to say. And approach it from that perspective, as opposed to, God bless America, when is it my turn to talk? You know? And I like to chalk it up to people who are drinking too much coffee, or they live on the East or West Coast, and so they are moving faster than the rest of the world. But if I look at it from a positive perspective, this person has a lot to say, and they really want me to hear it, But I would eventually say to them, do you know that there was one woman I was talking to after church. I didn't know her, so I never did. But I thought if I ever got to be her friend, I might say to her, when you ask me a question and then you interrupt me when I'm answering it, I really begin to wonder whether you really want to know my answer or not.
That's nice.
I didn't do it because I just met her, and I chalked it up to her being nervous because it was her first time at our church, and she's come back, and I haven't talked to her again. But that the first step is to say, okay, how do you look at that from a positive motivation rather than calling it interrupting? Because, I mean, you have to call it that, but, you know, when you ask me another question while I'm trying to answer yours, or when you start to tell me your opinion when I'm still sharing mine, I wonder if you really care about what I think. Isn't that true? I mean, isn't that the most frustrating thing about the interrupting? Is it, wait a minute, if we all get turns here and you keep taking my turn, you must not be valuing me. And I don't think the person is doing that. I mean, I have cousins in Boston and in New England who I sometimes laugh and say, when is it my turn to talk? Because they just interrupt all the time. They just have so much to say. People in New York are the same way, you know. But I don't think they are deliberately disrespecting or deliberately not interested in what you have to say. They just have a lot of their own stuff to say. Does that help? Is somebody on the chat room asking that?
Yes, that helps me. I'll see if they chat more. I would say that back to the wolf pack for a moment, and even dogs, but more so wolves because they're more organized because they all kind of have an order. That again, they would be nipping. It wouldn't be violent. It wouldn't be, I'm going to rip your face out. It would just be a nip, like, nope, modify that behavior. That doesn't work for the group. So.
Well, if it's one-on-one and you're really good friends, you just say, hey, you're interrupting again.
Yeah.
That would be one thing. But if you're in a work environment or a group of people and you meet often, I think it's worth having a conversation about it. I really don't think they know they're doing it. That's my basic premise, is that for the most part, whatever the difficult behavior is, the individual is not aware of what they're saying or what actions they're taking, and they're not aware of the impact, especially if we haven't told them. And if we just get madder and madder and madder, more and more angry, and then we blow up at them, that's just not very helpful. Doesn't get us anywhere. We feel better, but it doesn't change anything.
Right, and you've built up a massive charge on something that they're not aware of.
Yes, and it's all in your head. That's the trouble.
Oh, that's a tricky area.
All that rage and anger and frustration is all like, because I want that other person to be different.
Insert expletive of choice. Yes.
Exactly. I hate it. But
yeah.
That's the way it is. I'm not saying it's simple. Well, I will say I think it's simple, but it's not particularly easy. Because you really have to wrap your brain around it. One of my friends calls it kind of a neutral approach. And if that helps you, go for it. I like to look at it more from the accepting and curious. Okay, if this person is manipulative, how can I see a manipulative person in a positive way? How can manipulation be described as a positive thing? And where I go is, well, whoever it is, they really know how to get people to do what they want. They're very persuasive. It's just, you need to, you know, it needs to not be malicious. But if I look at them that way, then I'm less apt to be critical and judgmental of them, and I'm more apt to be able to have a conversation.
I like it. How do we...
Thanks.
Now I'm really... Wow. This got fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do people work with you? I mean, I once again, I will say that I cannot recommend highly enough that people get your book, Lessons for a Difficult Person, A. B, look at the exercises, look at some of the, you know, like really the belonging, I think, you know, the belonging list and the working on that and just, you know, the acknowledging of it. And just what you do, what we just talked about now is not building up that pile of stuff in your brain because you're making it up.
That's so frustrating.
And I'm my hand is now up and I'm testifying. You're making it up, and I know what that's like because I do that. My name is Richard, and I make blank up. So, you know.
Well, the way people work with me is they usually communicate and say that they'd like to get some coaching. I do like 3 to 6 sessions of coaching. It doesn't usually take more than that. And other times people will invite me like to their group or their church or their office or whatever to do a workshop, which is really my favorite thing to do. But traveling, that's not always possible. So sometimes we just do it one-on-one.
Okay. And people can find your book and your information where?
On sarahelliston.com.
Great. Okay.
And if they can't find that, they can go to Amazon and look for Lessons from a Difficult Person, or they can type my name in, Sarah Elliston, and then all my information's in the book.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I will say that I'm looking forward to your up-and-coming book, Lessons for Difficult People Online. That's another show. We can't do this now. I so want that, though.
Okay,
wow.
Well, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
So far, the requests have been coming more towards, what do I do if I'm a difficult person? And so that seems to be the second book, more like if you think you're a difficult person, people have said, well, how did you change? Well, you know, it's a process. There are probably people in my life today who would tell you that I still have moments of difficultness.
Right.
I just now I can look at them and say, oh, am I being difficult? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
If it's making people around you uncomfortable, is that kind of one of the definitions of a difficult person?
I think that's a good one. Yes. I don't really have a definition, so I think that's a great one. If it's making them uncomfortable or it's hindering whatever the behavior is hindering, group success or clients, you know, in a work situation where it's turning customers away, that kind of thing. When I was managing a volunteer program at City Hall in Cincinnati, we had a volunteer who was very loved, but she needed to bathe on a regular basis. And her supervisor, the office where she worked, came to me and they said, you need to tell this woman she needs to take more baths. And I said, well, if I tell her that, she's going to know that you told me. And we had this dialogue about it, so we did a three-way. I mean, I went in and sat in on the meeting, but I ended up actually having to say it because they just couldn't spit the words out, but that they really liked her and they wanted her to work there and they needed her to bathe on a regular basis. And that's a pretty powerful behavior change.
Wow.
Yeah. And she stayed. She stayed. But it was a toughie.
Yikes. Okay, yeah. We must stop now, as much fun as this is.
Okay. I've enjoyed it myself.
That's
Sherry,
excellent.
Are we okay? Or did I handle your question in a helpful way?
Yes, and it gave me a lot to think about. But Richard often takes the lead because he has more interesting questions than I do. So it's not that I sat in the background because of anything you said. I accept the need to change, and I've been sitting writing furiously about
okay.
a 40-year marriage and things that I don't
appreciate.
Well, I applaud
you. I only lasted 25 years in my marriage, so I think 40 years is incredibly powerful and successful. I wouldn't begin to suggest you did anything wrong.
Well, to get him to talk at all is a miracle. So
there you go. Yeah.
Maybe that's a good start. About grammar.
Yeah, maybe you have to have more conversations about grammar.
Exactly. All right, everybody.
I have to
thank
tell you,
so
I'm
much.
In his corner. But, I agree. I hate reading stuff on the internet when it's badly written. That makes me mad.
Well, we certainly need to hear more from you, so let us know when your new book, whatever it is, comes out.
Okay. Because
we certainly want to hear some more from you.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Everybody have a great rest of the week, and we'll see you on Tuesday. We're talking about something I can't tell you now, of course. All right, everybody. Bye-bye.